You may have noticed our new branding and our fabulous new website, thestagechefpodcast.com. Well, as musicians, do you ever finish your song, EP, album, really happy with what you created, but think, what now? What's next? What visuals suit the work I've created? What about the graphic design? Or even worse, you hire a photographer who you spend money on, they don't quite land the vibe you're going for. Well, the answer is Who's Hughes, which is run by the creative genius that is Bastien Hughes, who is a brilliant musician in his own right and will take your nuanced story and create a vision around it. Such a clever process that Bastien has designed and really is the answer to your kind of what's next question. So if you head to bastienhughes.com, that's BastienHughes.com or Instagram Bastien Hughes, the first 5 people who mention Stage Left will get a free branding consultation session with him, which I cannot tell you, you know, how valuable that stuff is, really. So do go over to BastienHughes.com, because many times we get sucked into a world of doing take after take or endlessly tweaking mixes for our work of art we created, and then just think, well, what's next, what now? Well, BastienHughes.com is your answer, because it's a safe, trusted pair of hands for the next stage of your work of art.
I mean, especially with the B-sides, it's like loads of times I've heard songs that we've obviously just done and just got down and recorded and not even thought about again. It blows my mind a lot of the time of our extensive back catalogue. It's forgotten half of it, you know what I mean?
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Today we are joined by founding member of the Choral, bassist, multi-instrumentalist and backing vocal harmony king Paul Duffy. Today we'll be discussing how on earth a band decides their B-sides from album tracks when there's zero dropping standard. We'll be hearing the highlights of supporting Oasis and getting advice on how best to split songwriting credits on a song-by-song basis, and we'll be finding out if Paul has ever been in a pub and got excited enough to jump up and down and start dancing when the bass intro to Dreamin' of You came on the jukebox, only to realise it was actually the start of John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John's sexed up summer loving duet from Greece, a moment which led to mockery from everyone else in the pub, much like that happened to me a few years ago back in Lloyd's Number One in Hornchurch. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Paul Duffy. Thanks for joining us today, Paul. How's it going?
Yeah, good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Cheers, man. So the very last gig I went to before kind of COVID, so we're recording this, by the way, for listeners who are kind of listening in the future, in August 2021. So the last gig I went to, the last night out I had, was seeing you guys support Supergrass at Ali Pally.
Yeah, and then that's very, right. Very, that seems like ages ago, that, yeah. Now, don't it?
And it was quite an interesting night, because there was this kind of sense that, like, things going to be changing. We never knew it was going to be as drastic as it turned out to be. But I just wonder if you could tell us, you know, talk us through that support tour and how kind of things kind of progressed, and whether you realised what was happening at the time, and that would be kind of the final tour you'd be playing for a while.
Well, I mean, to start with, to support such a great band like Supergrass, I suppose that begins with our very first trip to America. We supported them back in, God knows, you know, 2003, maybe 2002, something like that. Supported them all over America, and it was great. You know, like the first big US tour, you know, to be supporting someone like that. I think, I don't know what album they were on. Life on Other Planets, is it?
Yeah, I know that one. Yeah, it's a great album, yeah.
Yeah, amazing, yeah. So we got to know them, obviously, through them, and like had a great laugh with them and all that. So we'd done a few other gigs here and there. We actually did their farewell gig, whenever that was, in Manchester. That was interesting. Like, and then obviously they made a big, massive comeback, which was great, recently, innit? So just got the phone call, basically, because we know Gaz and Danny and Mick, like, so it was like an honour to play him, and especially the Ali Pally. But then coming back to what you're saying about like the sort of atmosphere and what was to come, obviously no one had any clue, absolutely no clue, because you would have thought, you know, there's just as a nation, in it, we're all a little bit like, oh, we're fine, absolutely fine, innit? But I meant, because that was so close to the actual first lockdown. Because I remember, like, it was my mum's 70th birthday, and we went to, because I brought her along, you know, to go to London and like, see the sights and all that. And it was, you know, just booming, normal day, normal, you know, tourist attractions all open and whatnot. So, yeah, to say, oh, yeah, no more gigs. What a massive blow. Because we did Manchester with them in the Victoria Warehouse, like, a few days before. And that was boss. It was really good. And then it was like, oh, I'll do the Ali Pali. And Supergrass were meant to go on to do, you know, a world tour. I remember the dates on their poster, but that must have been a massive blow to them. Mm. Yeah, that was just a shocker.
And it's really interesting you played their farewell show. So a show like that must have been so surreal, because when they were kind of finishing, that was seen as that was it. What was the atmosphere like backstage, if you're happy to share? Just like, was it a bit awkward or a bit weird, or was it euphoric or celebratory? Like, how did it feel? Because they're a bit like you guys in that they grew up very young together and kind of grew together. So it must have been a very strange night for them to.
I like that you mentioned that. Yeah, we did feel those similarities in the. It was just like a mad little group. When you see like old footage of them, it's like they were a mad little gang, weren't they? The atmosphere, I seem to remember it being they were done, you could tell. I think Gaz was like wanting to do like his own thing, but you know, I can't really speak for them, I don't know. But I do remember one bit, I felt really bad for them on stage when they were playing. There was meant to be obviously this big moment where it was like sort of like vignette bit on video, and it was like a montage of them. It was all building up to like a moment, and they were meant to kick into Moving, and his guitar just didn't work.
Oh no!
You know what I mean? And because I remember being on the balcony, and I'm like, hey, do you know when he just gutted for someone, and you could see he was just like, I'm done. It was harsh, really. So, but you know, yeah, I say I can't really speak for them, but yeah, the great lads. I mean. When we see him, yeah, we get on with them really well.
And you're right, I can definitely see like similarities between the two bands. And you obviously played with Danny Goffey as well, because you played a show. Tell us about the show you did in Liverpool. I think it was at the Philly, playing Sgt. Pepper's for 50th anniversary, is that right? And you would have been a rhythm section with Danny, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It was in Paris, actually.
Oh, it was Paris, right, okay.
In like 2017. That was amazing. Well, it was Goffey on drums, Gaz Coombs gets me on bass, obviously. We had it was run by Ed Harcourt, who's worked with loads of people, and he's like Marianne Faithfull and Nick Cave and, you know, Nick Ellison and all that. So I never met the guy, so I was getting the train to Liverpool. I just got like a phone call, and it was just like, oh yeah, I'm Ed. And I was like, okay, mate, you know, I heard of him, like. I was just like, oh great. He's like, do you wanna do a Sgt. Pepper thing? It'd be great to actually get a Scouser on board. And I was just like, yeah, yes, please. You know, so, and also, I didn't mention it, little Barry on guitar as well. One of the best guitarists ever, I think. But yeah, what a show, what an opportunity. Really, really good. Basically, just lived in Paris for about a week. It was great. Just rehearsing in like this big, big posh like venue.
So we had Danny Goffey on the podcast in the past talking about playing with McCartney, but he was playing on bass on, they were part of the Band Aid, basically, backing band, which was also include Johnny Greenwood and Tom York, which is a ridiculous lineup. So, and it was interesting to hear Danny Goffey talk about kind of Macca on bass, et cetera, et cetera. What's Danny like to play in a rhythm section with? And did you know all those parts already, or did you have to learn a lot of them?
Well, yeah, that's a lot. Like, you know, obviously very familiar with the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper. But one of the most fun things to do was to like pick it apart and learn the bass parts, which, you know, Mac is one of the best, isn't he? Mm. So just to kind of like, you know, I was getting on like YouTube videos and even just like listen to the album and even got onto like tracks that, you know, sort of solo the bass as much as it can. Just, you know, just blew me head. Like, he's so good, it makes you sick. Do you know what I mean? Just like, how are you that good? So that was just like, that was a journey. Really enjoyed that. But Danny, he's one of the best drummers, isn't he? I love his feel. He's like even like with the Supergrass, he's always like a little tiny bit behind. But that's what's great. And I've always appreciated and admired that in his playing. So I had that in mind. I was thinking, oh, he's, you know, he's got his own kind of thing. Like, at least his fill-ins are always like, you think, is he going to make it? Is he going to make it? And he always just does. So, I mean, he's very much like Ringo, I guess. Because it was like, you know, his feels, it's quite similar in a sense. I mean, he was a joy. He was a joy to play with because played with, like, lots of other people, obviously. And it's always the drummers, you know, that makes the kind of difference. You know, you can play with, like, other guitarists. They can do their thing and you can just do your... But, yeah, as a bass player, you've got to lock with the drummer. And Goffrey is, yeah, one of the best, obviously. Because, like, the thing with, like, even with Ian, in the Ian Skelly, might be a bit biased, but there's no one else like him. So it's always to play with another drummer, because I've played with Ian, because he's one of the best in the world, I think. It's just, you know what I mean? There's no comparison.
Yeah, I mean, it's every drummer's individual, right? And locking into rhythm section is so important. And to jump from kind of playing with someone since the age of, like, whatever it was, 14, 15, 16, and then play someone else, that is a tough gig. Actually, on the subject of Ian, you know... siblings in bands, like, obviously, you know, there's famous examples of siblings in bands, right, which we won't go into. But what's your role if they're kind of disagreeing on something that's music related? Like, do you kind of put your, you know, just think, I'm going to stay out of this because it's brothers? Or is it a case that you kind of compartmentalize the fact that they're related in any way and you just think about it as a band? Like, where's the there's a lot of gray area there, right? So what's your role if they're disagreeing on something musical?
I mean, to be honest, there's not much to kind of disagree on, because I think being brothers, they're quite similar minded, strong minded. Don't get me wrong, you know, everyone is in the choral. I think that's why it works. But I suppose I just let them, I let them do them and get round, get round all the corners and stuff of their mind. And but it just works, I guess. I mean, I sort of see myself as just, you know, I don't know, like, yeah, like, what would you call it? Like, the sort of, like the in-between.
Yeah, the mediator.
The in-between guy.
Mediating.
Yes, definitely. Like, I'm the bridge that makes it meet all in the middle. But yeah, it's I can't really explain, to be honest. It just works. Like, coming back from, you know, the lockdown, even now, we hadn't played together for, you know, whatever it was, a year and a half. We got back in the practice room the other week, and it was just, you know, it's like old times. It's like never been away. It's just, you just, when you're a unit, you just lock, and it's an unspoken musical bond, I think.
Now, what are the things that, like, completely stands you guys apart, particularly, like, it's really noticeable when you were that young, is like the harmonies that you guys would sing. Like, it was just, I always think, if you see a young band, like, particularly, like, you know, as young as you guys were, like, really nailing harmonies, that shows such a, like, a sophistication, like, and it's really sets the kind of amateurs from the pros, you know, aside from each other. And I think it was so, like, professional. The harmonies you did were just so beautiful, and you continue to do. Now, what's really interesting, if you speak to a lot of, like, I know loads of male singers who are really, really good lead singers and can sing anything, but actually they really struggle with harmonies without accidentally going into the main lead. So how did you learn to sing harmonies as effectively?
You know what, the Beatles again, I must say, Macca, and yeah, you know, I was just listening to them. I used to, in my early teens, I used to, like, sing the harmony. I used to be able to pick out the harmonies of, like, yeah, say the Beatles and, even like the Kinks, that, you know, it's usually just like a two part with the Kinks, but they're always, like, really interesting and whatnot. I mean, growing up, we used to listen to a lot of harmony groups, like Beach Boys, And like even like going back to what the Beach Boys were into, like the Four Freshmen, and even like the Cordettes, like doing Mr. Sandman, and I was banging to Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and stuff like that. So it was just in all the music that I listened to, and I just found that really interesting and really like I want to do that. You know what I mean? It's like if I'm going to be in a band, I want to be able to just, yeah. And I felt like a really important thing, in a way, in Liverpool. If you can't harmonise, it's like you get out of town. Like, it's just like every band, it's always impeccable harmonies. I mean, there's some bands that are, I'd say, probably even better harmonies than us in town. But so I guess there's the pressure there.
Yeah, I mean, you guys really nail it. I mean, particularly, I was listening. I mean, you know, you've got so many, you know, you guys are really prolific, but Eyes Like Pearls, I've been listening to that like nonstop for like the past week. I must have listened to it about 50 times, and just the harmonies on that are just so, so good.
Nice one.
Love it. So, obviously, you know, so you guys all got together about the age of 14, and now, like, you're kind of, you know, you're around your 30s, right? So, like, people change so much in that time. And,
yeah.
Like individually, like no one is the same person as they are when they're 14, right? So that, how has the dynamic of the band changed and the personalities? And like, is it completely different dynamic now to what it was when you first, you know, started the band in regards to like decision-making and personalities and stuff? Or have you kind of all stayed quite?
I'd say there's still similarities. As I say, there's just something that just works with us. And that's a sort of unwritten and unspoken. But I say we've done a lot of growing up, I'd say. Because, you know, starting off, I was 17 when we first got signed, you know what I mean? So, absolute baby. Really confident and really, really sure of ourselves, even then. So we weren't, like, scared or anything, do you know what I mean? We were on a mission. It's what we're good at, you know what I mean? Even in like the early days. But just, yes, a lot of growing up, and I mean, we packed in the weed as well, so that's the biggest change. But no, to be honest, not really. Just as in, I suppose just our personal lives have changed a lot. So that maybe reflects into our decision making now. And I suppose it's not as like regimented now. As in the early days, it was like, you know, we just practice every day, which made us as we are now, I think, and really good musicians. I think, you know, we paid our dues, put it that way.
Yeah.
I suppose it's a bit more relaxed now, and, you know, musically, we're at that point now where we can just do it. It's muscle memory. It's just, yeah, it's what we're good at. We know how to work together and sort of not get hung up that much anymore, you know. Like, try it. Because I remember there was, like, a moment where it was just, you know, like, doing, especially in the studio, like, take after take after take, you know, sort of, like, burning yourself out a lot. Like, it's got to be perfect. It's got to be this and that. Trying different things and sort of not really understanding it and then racking your brain and, you know, getting frustrated and things like that. But that's just with age, I think. Again, I think this is the maturity of musicianship and just how you handle yourself and not to, yeah, get bogged down. And, you know, like it doesn't really matter that much, if that makes sense, you know. I always remember there was like a moment in my life, especially like for live, like a live standpoint, you know, you're kicking yourself after like a gig, like you've made a mistake or something, you know, you hit a bum note here and there, and you like walk off the stage and like, no, I was rubbish, you know, kicking chairs and all that. And I remember just like one day, it was just like, you know what, it doesn't matter. And no one notices anyway, you know, like when you're kicking off and someone goes, oh, did you? Did you make a note? I didn't hear. And you're like, oh God, yeah. And you sort of have to like have a word with yourself.
But maybe, maybe keeping those standards that high then got you to where you needed to be, right? So like maybe, you know, even if no one else in the band or no one else in the crowd noticed that you hit a bum note or whatever, like maybe just having those really high standards at that stage of your development probably helped you get to where you needed to be, right? But, you know, it is cool that you kind of, you know, you can chill out over it a bit more, I guess, now.
No, I absolutely. I think, yeah, you know, it's just because you care, isn't it? You know, like, but yeah, no, it's finding the balance. I do remember there was like, yeah, moments. So I was just like, you know, like kicking yourself and really like, you know, giving yourself a hard time. And it's just like, it's not worth it. Mm. You know, it's meant to be fun. You know what I mean? You're meant to have a good time. But I don't know. I guess that was, we were on the road a lot in the early days, like. So I don't know. Yeah, it's part of the game, isn't it? I guess.
And you talk about being on the road there. What's, apart from obviously you mentioned Supergrass, what's been your favourite support tour and why?
Good question, because we've done a lot of support slots over the years. Do you know what? Oasis, I think, was a massive, massive high point. Even though it wasn't the Oasis of early days, you know what I mean? It was like, it was the
post 2000s.
Don't believe the truth. It line up.
Yeah,
Gem and Andy, and they had Zach Starsky on kit though.
Yeah.
The first time we done like gigs with them, but mate, yeah, I mean, to meet them too. Do you know what I mean? It was just like, you know, like when the first time we kind of starstruck, like proper, like oh my God, that's them. I mean, we'd met Noel before. Obviously, and he's always been a really, you know, supporter and, you know, like a champion of ours. Like, but to me, when I first met Liam, I always remember like that's Liam Gallagher. Wow, he came like, went, all right, mate, you know, nice shirt. And I think I just went, and he just looked at me and was just like, all right, mate, just carried on. You know what I mean? It was hilarious, and that, I think that was the only word I ever spoke to. Well. Mumblings I ever spoke to.
How long a tour was it? And, you know, what's it like touring with Oasis? Like, I wonder if you could just tell us, like, what's a day like? I mean, do you go and see the band after each set that you do? Do you travel with them? Do you travel completely separately? Like, you know, 99.9% of the world have not travelled with Oasis or supported them. Talk us through it. What's it like?
Well, I mean, travelling-wise, obviously, that they're in, you know, they're on their level. Yeah. I mean, I think they had a tour bus each, I think. Private planes and all that, isn't it, with them? But I was really, yeah, like surprised in how the hospitality and how like generous they were. So I was thinking, oh, you know, you're going to get their security, big hands in your face. No, where are you going? Which I think to an extent there was, because, you know, they got like personal bodyguards and all that. So, but the fact that they just, yeah, after the gigs and even before, they're just like, yeah, yeah, come backstage, come in our room. You know what I mean? Like, I literally just hanging out with them. Like, yeah, go on, you know, make yourself a drink, you know. Have a smoke and all that. It was just like incredible how like genuine and how just sound they were. But I think we hit them when they were like generous and sound, and I think been through their, you know, ups and downs at that point in their career. Because I remember our tour manager at the time, Pete Hillier, he was just like, oh my God, they've changed so much. He was like, it's just so chilled out now. Because I think he's probably been around them in their peak, which, you know, in anyone's, you know, professional musical peak, you're a bit of an arsehole. You know what I mean? I think we were in our small little way. I think we were like nightmares at some point. But no, it was just great. So we mostly did Europe with them, and obviously huge arenas. So I'm like, you know, sadly, it's the catering I remember the most. I mean, that's one good thing with them support slots and supporting a big band. You get really good catering. But no, yeah, highlight career, absolutely. Yeah, really good.
Amazing. So one thing that I find like really interesting about the fact that, because you guys were so young and like you're still like absolutely smashing it now, that like most people listen to this between the ages of say like 16 and 30 may well have just done jobs to kind of get by and just kind of like, you know, had some fun as they kind of went by, but maybe set themselves up to enjoy maybe work and whatever they do a bit more later in life. And they were just kind of doing stuff to get by. But your life has kind of been the flip of that in some ways. Like you've absolutely smashed it and done, like, you basically lived the dream, I'd imagine, that you'd wanted to between the age, you know, that age group. And out of interest, because you talked about like the stresses of, you know, not stresses, but some of the challenges of touring and stuff like that. What percentage of what you've done since the age of 16 has felt like a job? Has it felt like 100% a job, or like 0% or 50%? Like, how much is it just you go, oh, another day at the, you know, another day at work?
Tough question, because I mean, it definitely doesn't feel like a job. I mean, I can't, there's nothing I can really compare it to, because I've been so lucky. As I say, I was 17 when we signed, like real proper job, and that was glass collecting. That was at a weekend, you know what I mean? So it's just like, it definitely doesn't feel like a job. But then saying that, as I said earlier, when we were very regimented at the early stages, that was like, you know, that was like our job. And it felt like, because, you know, we were getting paid to do it. We were getting like, you know, We started off on like a wage, which probably a little bit silly at that stage of our lives, because, you know, we just blew it, all the money basically. We're getting like 200 quid a week, which, you know, as a 17, 18 year old,
nice,
pretty good, yeah. For just, yeah, you know, a little, you know, rehearsal. I'd say we do, you know, rehearsals was like, you know, all day. Go back for something to eat and go back in the night, you know, because that's all we did. No, and we loved it then anyway. But yes, like not seeing much of anyone else really. Not really like a big nightlife either. We were just in the practice room or the only nightlives we had was doing a gig or, you know, DJing or, you know, whatever, or even just going for like a little drink and that afterwards. But we weren't that much of a going out type of band. We were just in our little bubble, just, you know, yeah, prachian, going back home, listening to tunes, watching mad films. So, yeah, it never felt like a job, I must say.
Amazing. Top, I mean,
yeah, no, I've been dead lucky, obviously, but
hey, mate, you make your own luck, right? So, you know, that's nice you say luck, but like, you know, you've written, you know, or been involved in so many like great tunes and great albums that, you know, you make your own luck. I mean, one thing that I think that splits up a lot of bands or creates fractures within bands is how like songwriting royalties are like decided. And I'm not going to be too personal here about like how exactly you split things up, but I'm kind of interested in that. It doesn't appear that you guys have like a hard and fast rule. So it's like some bands would say, okay, if this person kind of wrote the kind of the skeleton of the song, then that's going to be that person's song, and whatever someone plays on top of it is still part of that person's song. Others will go, right, okay, let's just split it equally. But you guys, it appears that you do it on like a song by song basis. It's like, how do you, like, are you just constantly having conversations over WhatsApp about like, okay, so this one's going to be all of, you know, because this, you know, you've written, you know, on the last album, like you've written a song that's entirely your credit, but there's other ones that, you know, James has just written on his own, but there's other ones that say like Jay Skelly, Power, Ian Skelly as well. So like, how do you divide it up on a song by song basis? Like, are you not just in constant conversations about that?
You know what? I'm not really like clued up on like the kind of royalties or the, you know, the of that side of it, but it's just, yeah, credit where's credit's due, really. But I remember the early days when we first signed, it was 50-50, 50% going to James because he was like head songwriter, you know, like, I mean, you know, he'd done like Dream of You and like, yeah, you know, obviously that was like our big hit then. So I remember, yeah, it was 50-50 split, 50 for the rest of the band, 50 to him, as in the songwriting.
Yep.
Publishing credits, royalties go. But I'm not sure how much that's probably maybe not in the contract anymore, because that was when we signed with Deltasonic/Sony. So now I'm not too sure, to be honest. But it's just, yeah, it's just credit where credit's due for the album, really. And I think, I mean, that's probably a big difference in where in how we are now and where we're at. It used to be, I think it used to be like a bit of a struggle to get you to get it like fair and whatnot. But now, because Ev can write a song now, you know what I mean? Like Ian had his solo stuff, and then Paul Molloy joined, and he's like a brilliant songwriter, great musician as well. You know, see, Nick's always had his hand in. It's, you know, a lot of the songs is Skelly Power. I mean, as myself goes, I've tried writing songs, because you can't do lyrics. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you wrote Pavilions of the Mind, right?
Yeah, the music.
Oh, you got the music. Right, okay, got it. Right, okay, cool.
Yeah, no, like the actual, you know, the spoken word stuff's all Nick.
Right.
Yeah, no, I just did the instrumental in the background music, because I mean I do a lot of soundtrack work as me personal sort of thing that I do at home. So. Not nothing like major, but just like, yeah, little projects here and there for like independent filmmakers and animators and stuff like that. So I've got myself at a good level of, you know, creativity on that front. So I remember when Coral Island was, you know, becoming a thing, James saying to us, "What have you got?" kind of thing, because, you know, he's basically written most I'd say all of Move Through the Dawn, because that was like his mission to kind of get it on Radio 2. Basically, he was, I think his mental brief to himself was to, we need to get this on radio and to get credible again, and, you know, to be a player, which he did in an amazing way with, you know, the tune like Eyes Like Pearls, that was like straight onto Radio 2, I think, which was amazing. We got to do like the Chris Evans show and stuff like that, and I think that kind of put us back on the media map, you know what I mean? So when it came to Coral Island, it was like, sorry, it was like, you know, let's get sort of creative again as a unit and a little bit more free, and it was great. It was a great opportunity. And he just asked me, he's like, "What have you got? Have you got any instrumental stuff?" And I was just like, "Yeah, I think so. I can have a go." Like, so it was a great opportunity to just actually get something, you know, done by myself on it. Like, yeah.
So for listeners who aren't aware, so an album came out early by The Coral called Coral Island, and it's such an amazing, it's a concept album. So it's like, I think it's like 54 minutes, and it's got a narration kind of through it as well. And it tells this story of this kind of fictional place kind of at the end of the pier. Well, it's got The End of the Pier as one of the song titles as well. And really, really interesting concept. Did you have that ready to go pre-coronavirus, or is that something you recorded remotely during Corona?
I remember the idea for Coral Island was... way before, definitely, I think, like, pretty much around the end of, like, doing all the promo for Move Through the Dawn. So I think, because we started recording, I guess, probably about 2018, do you know what I mean? Like, just, like, messing around with stuff like that, and obviously 2019 as well. Just getting in the studio when we could, you know what I mean? And just making little things, and we did a lot of it in the studio. Don't remember like rehearsing it up much. I mean, a lot of the songs, I think, you know, James has probably had them in the pipeline for ages, you know what I mean? And it obviously takes kind of so long in the process to sometimes go, that's how that's meant to go, do you know what I mean? So I seem to remember we had the bulk of it way before the first lockdown, which is what, 2020, was it? March 2020, wasn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. So, I remember we had a lot of it done even before then. I'm just trying to think of when the last recordings we did, because obviously we couldn't go in the studio first lockdown. It was just like, nope, you know what I mean? Good, like... I don't know, four, maybe more months of just like actual complete lockdown, you know what I mean? So I seem to remember like just getting a few, just getting mixes sent. So like, there's like maybe like the producer Chris Taylor is still like, you know, just doing little mixes here and there for us. And I seem to remember they got going again, like the end of. Yeah, like end of 2020, started to like get going again. Do you know what I mean? With the recordings and a lot of like doing the overdubs and things like that, and like the sort of the concept coming together a bit more, and yeah, actually feeling like you know, like a thing, like a project. Because I remember there was a good moment. And I was just like, "What is this?" You know what I mean? What's happening? Because there's so many tracks. You know, I don't think it became the idea or the concept as a double album for a good while. Like,
It's a fascinating listen. And you talked about kind of production there and the way it's kind of come together. I've got a question. It's one to work through, but I think it's really, really interesting. So, former guest on our podcast, Ian Brody, has been on this podcast and talked about producing you guys. But I'm really interested from your perspective. You've had Ian Brody produce you guys, John Leckie, who did early Radiohead stuff, and Jeff Barrow and Adrian Utley from Portishead. And Jeff is going to come on the podcast soon as well. So I'm quite interested in, if Ian Brody was trying to get the best out of you, what would he be doing? You know, how did he get the best out of you, either individually or as a band? And actually how that differed to how John got the best out of you guys, and also how Jeff and Adrian got the best out of you guys. How did their production approach differ to get the best out of you?
Going back there with Brody, you know what, we learned, he was great because we learned so much from him. You know, we'd never even been in the studio really before meeting Ian. I mean, this stuff, even if he didn't know, the things he was like showing us, or like even just doing to make us sound good, you know, was just like unbelievable. I remember a lot of it was live takes, like the first album. None of it's not really that layered. It's not really overproduced, to be honest. I seem to remember him like going, I think that I just need, because I think in the early days we'd just done, you know, gigs, like showcases, and we were getting our name round, especially like round London as well. I always remember some guy saying to us, it's like, the thing with the Coral is, you're really young and you play really fast. It was like, oh, all right, sound. So I remember Ian Brody saying, I just need to capture that on record. Mm. But obviously, because in a kind of more controlled way. But no, it was amazing, such an eye-opener to just to even sit, like, you know, just to, you know, pull it back a little bit, you know, go a little bit here and there, and even just like how to approach singing. Because all we've done is live, you know, screaming and whatnot, and sort of like, you know, just, you know, battling with dodgy equipment and screaming fans on, you know, sweaty black boxes of despair, as they call venues. But yeah, no, Brody was great. It was great. It was just, it was a load of fun. And it was like the first time to see what, like, the little tricks you can do. And I mean, don't forget, it was still on tape back then. It wasn't digital, yeah. I think we were like one of the last big bands to sort of record only on tape. So it was like a lot of it had to be live to get it down.
And what about, how did that compare to John and to John Leckie then, and then Jeff Barrow and Adrian? Like, how did their approaches differ, or were they similar? Like, how did they, was anything really specific either of those did to really kind of, you know, get your sound down, or like make you feel relaxed so you can do a really good take?
Well, I remember because Ian Brody obviously did debut album and then Magic of Medicine, where like the sound of them is completely different, but it was what we wanted to do for Magic and Medicine. We wanted it really like wooden sounding. I think it sounds real. I mean that as in like you can hear the wood. You know what I mean? It's not like wooden as in stiff. Like you wanted it to sound like, it sounds like a big oak tree to me. But he captured that amazing. I think it was obviously just how we were playing at the time. But then the next person went on to was Adrian and Jeff. for Invisible Invasion, which was, I don't know, still early days, that one, like 2000.
I thought that was about 2007 or something like that, 2007, 2008, but that might be wrong.
Maybe. And I think before that.
Right, okay.
2005, right. 4, I think, yeah. Because, yeah, where did we go? Mano Valley. That was great. And like just like lived in Mano Valley for, God, months and months. I remember Jeff coming to the rehearsal room and was just like, again, I just need to capture that. Because we were still in that very regimented, we rehearsed every day. So we had the tunes all boxed off, you know. So he was kind of a bit like, what you're doing is great. I do remember Jeff, though, once he said to me, he was like, oh, I love your harmonies. They're like ELO. Oh. And I was like, what? Like, I've heard of ELO, but I was like, what? Like, oh, dad band, do you know what I mean? Like, because I was, like, still dead young then. He was like, honestly, mate, it's like, check out ELO, you'd love them. You're backing, you know, your harmonies is loads like it. So I went, all right, you know, checked it out. And I was like, yeah, man, that's boss. He was, like, he was kind of the first to double track, you know, like, your harmonies and the backing. So that was, like, amazing because we'd never done that. Up until then, I don't think. But he was great. He was quite like just capturing a mood. Like, great, that's done. You know what I mean? Like, move on, kind of thing. Instead of like sweating over it, and you know, because that's, as I said, that's what we used to do a lot. We'd like, you know, want to home in on everything. He'd be like, no, that's done. Just leave it. I think he was really impressed with Bill, Jeff.
Mm.
He's saying to remember he loved his like guitar work as well. So I think he was just trying to capture that in the best he could, especially in Invisible Invasion. Remember he loved the intro for Arabian Sand, which, you know, it's just like the guitar, chop. I think that's where he took the basis for Machine Gun on Porter's Red Third. Oh, if you get on that, duh, duh, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah, I know, yeah. Duh.
Da, 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 yeah, he loved that so much. He ripped it off. Openly ripped it off. Arabian sand, feel it slipping through your hand. Arabian sand. Arabian sand, a madness you can't understand. Arabian sand. Follow us on Instagram at the Stage Left Podcast, where you'll see behind the scenes photos from our interviews with members of Oasis, Queen, and Madness. He was great, and Adrian was brilliant as well. He was like, because he used these brilliant like soundtracks and, you know, how to get different noises and stuff like that. And I remember him showing me you can bow a cymbal. It makes it really like spooky noise. Oh. I was like, wow, that's amazing. Yeah, no, that was great. But yeah, I think it was just like, yeah, just for a one-off. I think it was just for a change, I think, at the time. It's just like, we really loved the sound of Portishead's records, obviously. Not like we wanted to recreate that, because it's obviously a completely different genre of music, and I don't think Jeff wanted to recreate it either. But that was a great experience. He was quite gung-ho, if that's the right word. And then we did Butterfly House. I know Roots and Echoes was next, wasn't it?
Roots and
Echoes. That was with Craig Sylvie. Mm. He was great, yeah. We met him through Jeff and Aid. I think he might have mastered or mixed Invisible Invasion. I think, remember, like, yeah, James and Nick really, like, you know, got on with him really well. And he did Roots and Echoes. He was brilliant. He was like quite like, yeah, live takes. Because that was in, where did we record that? That was Wheeler End, Noel Gallagher's old studio, which was great because we had these were big. It was like a big converted barn. Remember, we rewired, you know, from the control room into the barn to get a lot of takes from there. And that was, yeah, a lot of that was live. It was me, Lee, Bill, and Ian, just all, you know, just getting bass drums, two guitars down. I was like, yeah, take after take after take. I remember Craig going, okay, take 30. Godspeed. It was just like, okay. You know what I mean? Heads down, headphones on, heads down, just get it on, get it done even. That was good. He was just, yeah, relaxed, but like quite like I'd say hippie attitude kind of thing, but sonically getting some of the sounds, he was brilliant. He's really good at like mixing and like placing parts in the correct way. And again though, we'd got them songs rehearsed up to a point where you just had to recreate what we had on record. But then Butterfly House, which was obviously John Leckie.
Mm.
I don't know how that came about, John Leckie. Again, I think it was just like that. We wanted to like change it up. And I think obviously he worked on like Dark Side of the Moon, didn't he? I think he was like the tape operator for that.
Mm. Really? I didn't know that. That's in...
Yeah, wow. Yeah, he spliced the tapes and
nice.
But and Abbey Road, yeah. So I mean that connection alone, yeah. Just for me, because I'm a massive Pink Floyd fan. That was great, and then we obviously the Lars, Stone Roses, and God, these massive back catalog. I can't remember who else now, but I remember them. We were like really into those albums. Mm. I kind of think just James, just like this work and. Maybe someone I'd work well with, John Leckie. And we did. It was great. Remember him, though? He taught us a lot, because we had a big sort of rest after Roots and Echoes and Butterfly House. I think, like we'd done like tours and whatnot, but I remember we got, I think we had a new practice room around the time of that. And I'd just bought myself a MacBook. So it came with, you know, with GarageBand. Mm. I was just like, wow, you can record yourself. Do you know what I mean? So I remember that it was in the practice room every day, just demoing. That was like the first time. It was like, I could actually like, you know, get into things and, you know, and edit things ourselves. You know, because that's the way the world is now, isn't it? You can just, you can make a whole album like on your phone now. You know what I mean? That was like, he couldn't really do that just yet. So that was like, what, 2008, 2009, something like that.
Mm.
Yeah, so, yeah, just demos after demo after demo.
And then how do you choose what goes on the album doesn't? Because you guys, you released like a collection, like all your B-sides together. And I gave a listen to it a couple of days ago, and I just kind of assumed that there'd be like, you know, a drop in standard, or, you know, it's like the cuts that didn't quite make it, or like half finished songs or anything like that. And the standard is just exactly the same. Like there is no drop off whatsoever. So like, what's your process for deciding what makes the cut and what doesn't?
Do you know, I guess, it's, you know what, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. It amazes me, to be honest. I always forget. I mean, especially with the B-sides and like the singles collection and stuff like that. It's like, we did that. It's like loads of times I've heard songs that we've obviously just done and just got down and recorded and not even thought about again.
Mm.
It's just, it blows my mind a lot of the time of our extensive back catalogue. It's forgotten half of it, you know what I mean? But I guess James has got like in his mind what would make a good single, or it's maybe some particular feedback from someone. I know he used to ask his little brother a lot. Do you know what I mean? He'd be like, that's great, Dad. Or, you know, like a best mate of his would be like, that's boss, that should be a single, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's always, you know, a lot of the songs he's got already years before. Yeah, I think it's just whatever makes the record, I guess. It's always the track order, which is like the big sort of clashing heads together. No, that should go there. No, that should go there. I mean, you always start, you have a beginning and you have an ending. Mm. It's always what happens in the middle, or what happens, like track 8, track 9. It's always like, is it going to be like a dodgy filler, or, you know, something like that? So yeah, it's just a process that kind of happens naturally, really.
And I mean, you talked about all the producers you worked with there. Now James has gone on to be quite an accomplished producer because he's like obviously helped the likes of Shidru the Gun, who we've got on next week again, and like Blossoms, and been involved with that. How's that changed the dynamic when you all enter the studio? Is it like now old James has kind of got a bit of his producer hat on, or does he just still just be kind of songwriter, singer, guitarist? You know, has it changed the dynamic of the band now that he's kind of got these producing credits with other bands?
I mean, yeah, I'd say so, but only to a point, because as I said, we kind of know how we work. We have a kind of a way, but he defo knows more tricks. He knows more the jargon, put it that way. Do you know what I mean? You're like, you know, him and Chris Taylor, our producer now, yeah, they've got like a little secret language, which I'm like, what's that? You know what I mean? But no, he's just into it. Yeah, he loves it. He's like, it's got all like the know-how now, and like, because that's the thing like, that amazes me, is like the sonics and like, yeah, how things are placed within a song. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's just not even like on a musician level. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, yeah, like the technical head it's just amazing to have that as well. Mm-hmm. Which I think we all have to an extent, but yeah, to like, I'd say like there's moments where I'm like, that sounds fine. He's like, no, there's something there. And then Chris Taylor goes like, is it that? Like, and gets like the EQ up. Mm. And it's like, is it that? You know, and he's like, yeah, pull that down, get rid of that. And it's like, wow. You know what I mean? I'm like, no, yeah, that does sound better. Yeah, it's amazing to watch. Like, but no, we've all got our dynamics, and there's certain things that, like, I'll hear, and I'll usually more hate like musically, like that chord doesn't work, that note doesn't work, and they're like, really, it sounds all right to me. I'm like, I just can I just see what you're doing? Oh yeah, don't try this voicing, yeah, try that note. Oh, no, try that needs to be a minor. So yeah, we've all got producer ads when we get into studio, definitely.
Nice. And Par Street, I've been very lucky to, I interviewed actually Jim Sharrock for this podcast at Par Street Studios.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
got, I spent a night there actually, because they got a hotel there now, isn't there? And it's like, it's an amazing place. And obviously, you know, actually when I was there, all your equipment was all actually there, all kind of marked up with the coral and stuff like that. Do you mainly just use Par Street now, or do you use other studios, you know, in the last few years?
We've used Par Street as the last two albums, yeah. Or last three, even, with Coral Island. Yeah, what a great studio. Sadly, it's getting sold.
Is that definitely happening?
Yeah. Maybe, I'm not sure. I'll have to make sure if we can use this. It's sadly been sold, and Chris Taylor's moved all his stuff out. But between James, Chris Taylor, and the other guy who runs the place, Rich Turvey, they're all hopefully getting a new place in Liverpool.
Good.
Yeah, so, but yeah, Par Street, yeah, sadly going to be no more. I think it's going to be flats.
Yeah, I heard that.
But which is sad in a way, but I think it's just lockdown. It's just crippled everyone, didn't it? And I guess the building owners just like, get rid of it. Mm. So I think it's just too expensive. Okay. I mean, I remember Chris Taylor said to me, just that whole lockdown of not being able to pay the bill, you know, like, yeah, basically getting in debt because he can't pay the bills because he's had no work.
Yeah.
He was just like, oh, mate, it was too much. So I guess it's for that reason alone. But I mean, you can be in any room. If you're good enough and you've got the right gear and the right microphones and the right producer head, you can make good music anywhere. As I say, you can do it on your phone in your house and get great results if you just know what you're doing and you're into it.
Mm.
So, you know, it's sad, but I suppose it'd be great for a new start for people like us and other bands that come into Liverpool.
Mm.
You know, it might be something fresh, and you know, it's a new leaf in it for everyone, I guess. In general.
Mm. Now, a few years ago, it was just around the time that you were about to do that tour of the Oasis, Bill Ryder Jones stopped because he had like a stress related condition. And there's going to be lots of young musicians listening to this who are in bands. If they find themselves in a band and another member of the band is, you know, experiencing a similar thing, what advice, having gone through that, would you give them?
Tough on that, because I mean, I think it's especially now, I think like mental health awareness is such a more forefront subject now. But I think even then, we just didn't know what to do. I don't think anyone knew what to do, really. I suppose I look back on something like that and it's like, you know, I feel like wish I was there for him a little bit more. But as I say, we were just in this mad bubble. I was just like, oh no, just keep on the road, do an album, keep on the road. No, it's what you do, it's what you do. You know, like panicking a little bit, you know, with blinkers on in a way. And yeah, I'd say just, you know, I don't know. I haven't really got advice, to be honest, because it's different for everyone of how they handle it, even if you're personally going through it or you've got a friend going through it. But I guess there's just more information out there now, which is a good thing. For us, there was no information, so I suppose it was mishandled. But I guess it was the best thing for him to leave, I think, because now he seems to be in a better place, and we see him a lot, and he's a mate, he's a friend again, you know. And because I mean, that maybe that's what happened with us, you know, we stopped being friends, and it was just we were just on the road, and we were just, you know, band members and things like that. I mean, who knows? It's a funny old game, as they say.
I think there's a lot of good advice in there. You know, to be there for him, and the fact that you said that, you know, there's much more information out there now, just like, you know, directing people to where that information is and getting, you know, joining the dots for those people. I think it's the best thing you can do in that situation. Moving on in regards to, like, you talked about being on the road, et cetera, et cetera. When you know, on gig day, when, you know, let's say you've got quite a high profile gig, you know, you've done some really, really big, like, shows in America, like TV shows and stuff like that. How do you personally, like, relax on the day, or how do you, you know, you wake up in the morning and it's like the gig isn't till, say, like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. How do you pass that time effectively that isn't accidentally like, let's just start drinking from three or something like that, which is what a lot of bands can do. Well, and then fuck it up when it comes to playing.
I mean, yeah, if you're a veteran like me now, yeah, it's got to be 5 o'clock somewhere. Yeah, no, there's a danger. And I mean, back in the day, we just used to just smoke a lot of weed. And yeah, I think because of that, we smoked a lot of weed and stuff. I don't remember a lot of the early days, which is really bad. You know, you remember the good moments, you remember the bad moments, but the in betweens, you just forget, really, and you just kind of mess around. You know, if you're with your mates, it's fun, isn't it? You just have a laugh. I mean, I remember FIFA got played a lot on the tour bus and stuff like that. Watching stupid movies and like Steven Seagal films and stuff like that. Do you know what I mean? And Dolph Lundgren movies. They always get you through the hard times.
That's quote of the day, that is. Like, kind of on this topic of kind of touring and stuff like that, one thing that will, you know, a lot of bands, again, they might call it a day because they might play like one or two like demoralizing gigs. So I'd be quite interested. So it's a two-part question, this. What's the most kind of demoralizing gig that you play? Just so I think it's important that bands know that everyone goes through that. And also, what is the gig that, you know, if I gave you the opportunity to be in the audience for again and kind of experience from the audience perspective, what gig would you choose to kind of watch back? So what's the most demoralising and kind of what's the one that you'd love to watch back?
Demoralising, that's, to be honest, any gig, and to be doing what you're doing and what you love, you know, it's you've got to take any gig and just get up there and play the best you can. That's the mentality I always have. There's going to be someone in the audience or that hasn't seen you or, you know, wants to see you really bad. You know, you have your bad gigs and, like, there might have been, like, demoralising times, but once you start playing, it's just, you know what I mean? That's what you're there for, isn't it? You know, we've done a few support slots in our time where, you know, there's obviously not there to see you. Mm. You know what I mean? And, you know, this, I remember doing, like, the Enemy tour. We were, you know, that was the very first big major tour we did when we'd, like, first got signed. And it was us on first, Black Rebel Motorcycle, then the Lost Prophets.
What?
And then, yeah, I know. And then...
Wow.
So then...
what a night.
It was like that. Yeah, it was that kind of, like, odd new metal phase. Yeah. Like, you know, Jackass movies was out and all that. It was that kind of thing. And, like, yeah, party. Yeah. Smash a can on your head. And then there's us lobbed in in the front of it.
Wow.
So you can imagine the audiences then with, for us, you know, Dreaming of You and, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, we always had Skeleton Key in our arsenal. I always thought, you know, that's for, like, aggression. I remember, like, yeah, little goth kids or little, you know, goth, not even goth kids, I don't know what they were.
New metal.
New metal kids, yeah. You know, with little spiky hair and all that. I remember, like, literally in the front row, with flicking the birds up to us, you know what I mean?
Wow.
Just, like, middle finger, just, like, you know, mouthing swear words at us. It was just like, oh, my God. But then... That'd give us fire in our belly. I'd stare him out, you know, because I was 17, 18 then. I'd be like, ah, oh, yeah, do you want some? You know, whiz off like that, you know what I mean, getting all sweaty. So, I mean, that's how you handle it, you know. You just, yeah, you go, oh, I'm up here, you're down there, you know what I mean? That's obviously when someone's flipping the middle finger up at you. Yeah. So, I mean, that, getting, say, demoralising, not really. It's just, that's just what, you know, you get into the heckling and all whatnot. You know, it's part of the game and stuff like that.
And what about the flip side then? So if there's one gig you wish you could, you know, you could go and stand in the audience and kind of experience from the audience's point of view that you've played in the past?
Probably none of them, because I'll be pulling it apart in my mind. going, oh, I should have done that there. Oh, what am I doing there? Oh, God. That's one that I hate watching myself back, you know, say we're on telly or, you know, like a festival footage. Oh, God, I can't do it. I'm just watching myself going, what's he doing? Who's he? Do you know what I mean? So, I remember, like, the first, what was it? No, it was second Glastonbury, I think, we played. It was the other stage. It was, like, that perfect time of the day, sun was just setting, and we had that much kind of buzz about us.
This is Gem Archer, and you're listening to the Stage Left podcast.
I remember just, it seemed like, well, it probably was like, yeah, just thousands and thousands of people. We had that perfect slot just before the big main act at, you know, on the Pyramid stage. Yeah, obviously the, you know, we had the buzz and stuff. I mean, whether to watch it back or not, or be in the audience, but for me personally, just be standing on stage and to see that and to feel that, it's probably, yeah, up there for me. Like,
and what about when did Noel Gallagher join you on stage at one point?
Yeah, for Electric Proms. That was around Roots and Echoes,
right?
Yeah.
Was that impromptu? Was that planned, or was that kind of impromptu?
It was planned, yeah, because obviously it was Electric Proms, BBC show, and it was like, what's your kind of surprise? What? You know, because you have to have some kind of gimmick, I guess. And because we'd been in Wheeler End and we'd used the studio, we were like, oh, would you get up for a song? And he's like, yeah, all right. Like the way he is. Yeah, okay. And I thought, what's the most kind of rocking song that you'd probably want to do? And we got In the Rain. And that was boss, because I remember him standing in between me and Bill. And he didn't practice with us or anything. Just rocked up. Obviously listened to the tune and then just rocked up on the day. And I was just like, wow, that's how you do it. You know what I mean? When this 3-3-5 plugged in, it's just like, oh, boss. Yeah, no, it was nice.
One to tell the grandchildren, that one.
I mean, if they'll be like, yeah, sure.
Have you got any kind of like really important piece of memorabilia? Like, are you someone who like holds on to stuff, or if the house is burning down and like your family are all kind of taken care of, like there's something that you keep that's important to you that you've picked up over the last kind of 20 years in the music industry?
Well, I've got me coral box, you know what I mean, under the bed, which I've funnily enough just went through quite recently.
What's in there?
Lots and lots of AAA passes.
Yep.
Which I'm like, as I said, forgotten half of them. Like loads of, I've got like all like the enemies when that was an actual publication. Yeah. Got loads of them. What else is in there? Got like, yeah, some kind of demos on CD, stuff like that. And I remember like when we first went to Japan, that was like for like memorabilia or, you know, like little keepsakes. The fans over there was amazing because, they'd make things for you, or just gift you. Mm. I think it's like, I don't know, like, I think they just really appreciate you going over or something like that, or they just love it, and they'd give you gifts and, you know, little toys and things like that. And got like a few just, you know, random little robots that Japanese fans have given us. And I remember I found it was like a towel, like a little sort of hand towel with the coral written on it. These t-shirts that someone made, and it was like we had our names in Japanese written on the sleeve. Nice. Remember, like we were like, oh, and like great little design on them as well. We all put them on. I remember them like all laughing. It was like what? And they're like, that's your name written on your arm. It was like, oh wow. So I mean, yeah, probably like that's the most kind of precious things. But I've got lots of stuff. All the t-shirts as well, I've tried to like keep hold of. But I remember my mum had loads, and sadly, talking of house fires, she was moving house and she put her stuff in there, like a lockup, and it all got burnt.
Oh, shit.
So it was definitely arson. Oh, it was like, I remember, but you know, obviously with her personal stuff as well. I always remember it was my grandpa's piano. It was like a bit. Nice, upright, but a bit heavy, bulky, antique bloody piano. And it was always one of them. I was like, oh, you know, that'll be mine one day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yeah, sadly, went up in flames.
I feel such a dick to it. Like, I feel such a dick asking that question now.
No, it's all right. It's the great fire of the Duffy / Davy household. Yeah, so she lost loads. She had like, you know, amazingly, I managed to get like most of the NME stuff back myself, but she had it all in scrapbooks. Proud mum, do you know what I mean? So, yeah, it was like, oh man. But I found a few like photos and things like that. And like, but that's one thing. One thing I'd say, but I mean, it's part of culture now to take lots of photographs. Mm. Take photos if you're a young band on the road, and you know, I'm trying to take as much as you can in because I sadly didn't. Mm. And you know what I mean? Like, and you do forget half of it, especially if you're lucky enough to like get to like America or Japan, or, you know, even just go around Europe or Australia. Just, yeah, take as much as you can in, take photos and try. It is hard to go see things, go visit things. Mm. Even though, you know, sometimes you are knackered and you're just like, oh, I just want to go back to my hotel, or I just want to go on the tour bus. But yeah, now try and just, yeah, take as much as you can in.
So we're talking about advice, and maybe advice you'd give other people. You've recently become a parent, so you've got a 1-month-old. So just firstly, kudos for doing this. And, you know, I've got a 5-month-old. So like the next few months are just going to be a mixture of beautiful times and like lack of sleep and stuff, but it will all be great. What advice are you going to, you know, how are you going to feel about, you know, would you want your kids to go into the music industry? Is it something actually you'd want them to avoid? Like what advice would you give to them about if they started showing an interest about going into music?
I'd be happy to, you know, to encourage whatever they choose. But I suppose it's a different game now, though, isn't it? I just, you know, like, and to think of my daughter's generation, how it's going to be run then. Because now it's like, you know, like the TikTok world, isn't it? Yeah. It's like with content. It's like, oh, so what do you do on TikTok? You know, what do you do? Oh, just content. Like, content of what? Just content. And they've got fans and everything. You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, speaking of lockdown, that was TikTok just blew up, didn't it? And it's like a massive world that now. So you don't even have to like be in a band. Do you know what I mean? You can just like, have a TikTok page or like, which is, you know, amazing, isn't it? To think how much it's changed. But yeah, no, I definitely encourage pick up an instrument, whatever it be. You know what I mean? It doesn't have to be guitar. You know that you can be like, you know, even like recording at home or you know making music in any way. It's massive. It's such an important thing just to do. You know, not even just for skill and to join a band. Just I think it's just for me, it's just something special. And it's just great to have. It can soothe you as well, but it can, you know, you can let out anger as well. You can, you know, perform to other people, or you know, you can just perform it for yourself. It's like it's a special thing to have, I think.
I think it's a really good answer because I mentioned this on the last episode of the podcast, but something I do away from doing this podcast is I've got a qualification. I do training around supporting people around mental health and like how to support other people with difficult, you know, mental health crises. And actually there's this really interesting thing, which is this list of things that are protective factors of someone in a young age that if you kind of embed these, it's unlikely, you know, it decreases the likelihood of them going on and getting like mental health conditions. And there's also risk factors. And in the protective factors, one of them is exposing them to arts and culture. And, you know, a part of that is obviously music and that kind of thing. So absolutely the whole thing you said about soothing and like letting anger out, whatever it might be, it's really, really good to kind of have some kind of creative outlet in our lives just for lots of reasons, including our well-being. In regards to talk about working with like young bands and that kind of thing, tell us about the Lathams. You've been involved with support, like helping out with the Lathams, is that right?
That's right, last summer, I had the great honour of working with the album.
So much time. Your jewelry, I notice it is made of snow, but I can see the reason for us not to be can have an eye to eye.
So what was your involvement? What was your involvement?
Oh, it's kind of like musical mentor in a way. Yeah, I remember going to the practice rooms and, you know, because they're a lot like us, where they've just got so much material and they're always constantly writing. That it was a bit like, oh, that would be good. Let's work on that one. Because I knew they were going to go into the studio with James. And again, knowing James with his producer head and how he works and stuff like that, I kind of was, you know, letting him know what to expect as well. Mm. Basically I was there, I was like, okay, let's get that song up to scratch to where we're happy with it in the practice room. But know that it's probably going to get altered when they get in the studio and make it more of like a single, you know, or iron out all the creases and stuff like that. And like, I was like, James will alter it, but it'll be for the best. You know, just stuff like that. And working on the harmonies with them, stuff like that. So a lot of the harmonies on their albums, me. Yeah, doing a little bit of bass as well, a little bit of bass work. Oh no, it was great. And just hanging out with them because the funny lads, like funny. But yeah, that was like in lockdown, like sort of the thick of it lockdown. I was, you know, sticking my mask on, going to Wigan and working with them. It was great. It was really good. It was there hitting a wave and then bang, that happened to him. Well, happened to everyone. They couldn't do anything, but it was like you couldn't lose the momentum, you know. And like I think being like such young lads as well, it could have crippled them. They could have, you know, absolutely stopped and split up. And I was just there to keep it going. I think, you know, they want it, obviously. They want to keep going, but yeah, I was just there to you know.
They're definitely a band going places, right? I mean, it's really, really noticeable.
No, it was just to not like knock the wind out of the sails, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just like get them in the studio, because obviously Parr Street was like they were allowed to record, because that the government thing was like, oh, you can allow to go into a studio for work. It was like, okay, nice. Right, get in. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Get in now. And it was like, let's just get it done. So it's not like, because it was sad, really. Like, not sad, but just from my experience, like our first album recording, it's meant to be like bossing it and just having like a great laugh. And, you know, you can take it all the time in the world and there's loads of money getting thrown at you. Obviously, a massive different story for them. It was just like, mate, right, get these tunes done, get them up to scratch, let's get in the studio and bang it out. And it's what we did, and it sounds brilliant, the album. It's really, really good. And I think they're dropping it soon. But yeah, great band. Yeah, funny lads as well. Just funny to hang out with. So I can't wait to see what happens for them. Like.
And we're going to bring it to a close in a moment. A couple of last questions. Firstly, kind of what's next for you? So how's the rest of this year going to play out for you guys? And secondly, it's a question that we ask every person who comes on this podcast. What fears do you have for the music industry? And how might you address any of those fears?
Well, firstly, we've just got festivals to kind of obligations to fill. Mm. Yeah, reschedule festivals to do. So not a lot of live work, to be honest. But yeah, it's just nice. It's good to get back in the practice room and just be a band again and be a unit again. So just that, really, just regrouping again and finding our feet and, you know, just doing what we love again, which I've absolutely missed.
Fears for the music industry. But, so what do you have any fears for the music industry in the future?
I wouldn't say fears, because it changes all the time. Mm. You know, I wouldn't say fear, because then you know what I mean. Yeah. Then I just pack it all in and go, you know what I mean? And be a strange hermit, which it's always close to doing that. But I don't know. I've got a hope that with what's happening now, it's like there's, you know, venues seem to be opening again. Gigs seem to be back on. You know, it's like the only fear or the only worry I have is you can't plan anything because of what's happening, which is you know, one of the biggest things for a working band is to plan ahead. You know, you're always usually like, I've got a year plan ahead of you. Mm. You know what I mean? So, I mean, we've got next year, there is a somewhat of a plan set in motion. But, you know, yeah, it's the only worry is like it could all just stop again, which I'm hoping, and I think it won't, because it can't. It just can't. You can't keep doing it. I mean, in my opinion alone, I hate the way it seems to me anyway, that in the music industry and bands to perform, we've just been put on the back burner the whole time. You know, like it or not, and then you got the Olympics and like, you know, the Euros, which is great. But how can they seem to be go ahead, seem to have no worries? But then music, oh no, you can't do gigs because it's singing out loud. That can like spread it. It's like, oh, but you got like thousands of people crammed into Wembley for a Euro final. That's all right, is it? It's like, you can't keep doing it to us. There needs to be something. And I'm glad to see there's gigs happening and outdoor events and stuff like that. For a mental health shout, people need it. Mm. Not even just for like the industry, just people need it. Just on the last gig we just did, the Kaleidoscope Festival, one day thing. It was amazing, just to see people just out and you could feel the relief. Do you know what I mean? Because it wasn't even like out of hand or, you know, like, because I can imagine, like, what, you know, what governments thought, like, you know, the gig atmosphere is like, it's scummy, you know, like musicians, you know, they don't wash and stuff like that. You know what I mean? It's like, there's going to be spread here and there. It's like, well, nah, you know what I mean? It's like, everyone's dead sensible and like, it's just, it's sound. Like the other week, it was great. It was sound, didn't seem to be anything the matter, you know. So yeah, fingers crossed anyway. I'm just hoping that it's all gonna be okay.
Well, listen, Paul, thanks for your insight, your wisdom, your tips, your advice, your honesty of what it's been like for the last 20 years for you. Listen, you've written and played on songs that mean a lot of people, and I just say go forth and conquer. You've got so many more great years of music ahead of you, both as a bassist and as a mentor. Good luck juggling the upcoming festivals with parenthood, and thanks for being such a great guest on the StageF podcast.
Oh, thanks very much, Chris, that was great. Yeah, absolute honour to be on your show. Thank you so much.
This episode was scored, mixed and edited by Bastian Hughes, Bastianhues. And that's little Eliza Day, my baby, 4-month-old. He's making a bit of noise in the background, giving a endorsement to Bastian. You should get in touch with him on Instagram, whether you need support with your mixing, your editing, your scoring, or your website design, Bastianhues. He's doing a great job.